This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota. Journalism is sometimes referred to as the first draft of history. Sometimes the first draft has errors. And when newspapers are used for historical source material, misinformation can be repeated. A recent Dakota Date book referred to a religious group known as the Dukhobors in connection with a violent incident in the early 20th century. Several listeners complained, prompting us to look into the Dukhobors, who immigrated from Russia to Western Canada and the U.S. Jonathan Kalmakoff studies Dukhobor history. Ashley Androsov specializes in the history of Western Canada at the University of Saskatchewan. Both are Dukhobors, and they spoke with our Ashley Thornburg about inaccuracies that plague their faith and culture.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Likewise, glad to be here.
In early July, Prairie Public ran a Dakota Datebook about this conflict between Canadian authorities and an armed group of dissenters. This datebook was based on a 1908 article from the Hope Pioneer, and that article mistakenly referred to that group of armed people as the Dukhobors, and that prompted a number of constructive criticism feedback letters that we got from some listeners. So we want to set this record straight. Ashley, I'd like to start with you. What are the main tenets of a Dukhobor lifestyle?
Well, one of the main tenets of a Dukhobor lifestyle is a strong belief in pacifism, which is one of the reasons why the mistake in the article resonated so deeply with folks who are Dukhobors, because it's absolutely impossible for Dukhobors to be bearing armaments against any other person. To do so would be to cease to be a Dukhobor.
Yeah, this is a group of people that said even plowing your own field, you shouldn't be using oxen or horses. You should be doing this yourself, setting free the animal brethren. That is a strong adherence to nonviolence.
Part of that that pacifism comes from the belief that the spirit of God resides within the soul of all living things, and therefore to raise your arm or harm another living thing is really an affront and harm to God himself or herself.
So you don't have dominion over another species or even the land.
The land is very much considered something that we have a stewardship role over, but not dominion over.
A phrase that you'll see actually on the walls of the prayer halls in Saskatchewan Dukhobors prayer homes, you'll see the phrase toil and peaceful life. And that's something that Dukhobors really live by, toil and peaceful life. The idea that through our hard work, we are responsible for providing for ourselves and for our community. We should not be exploiting other people. We should be working for ourselves. And so there was a small faction of Dukhobors that took that to the understanding that resistance to exploitation of others should extend to animals as well as to people. And so a small faction of Dukhobors did decide to liberate their animals in the early 20th century, decided to do the work of the animals themselves. So, for example, if they needed to go and pick up goods from the market, they would pull their own cart to do so. But that was a very small faction of Dukhobors. The majority of Dukhobors did use animal power to break the soil in of prairie land and for transportation and so on. But in the earliest times of their life in Canada, the Dukhobors arrived with very few resources. Because of some of the problems they experienced in Russia, they had very few material possessions that they could bring with them. They basically started with virtually nothing, except for a financial gift from Leo Tolstoy that supported their migration, some support from the Canadian government, and some support from sympathizers like the American Society of Friends, for example, or Quakers, donated some materials for the Dukhobors. So in the early years, they didn't have a lot of capacity to buy horses or oxen to break the land. And that's something that that also led a small faction to believe that releasing their animals, whatever animals that they had, and doing the work themselves was an honorable and noble thing to do.
Well, thank you for that distinction. And we should talk about how the Dukhobors came to Western Canada, primarily British Columbia. There's a smattering as well in Saskatchewan. There are some in the United States, but the vast majority between the two countries would be in Canada. Jonathan, the Dukhobors came to Canada facing intense discrimination under Tsarist Russia, mostly because of this adherence to nonviolence, refusing to join the army. Can you paint a picture of what it was like to be a Dukhobor in Russia before they emigrated?
Certainly. So in the late 1880s, most of the Dukhobors in Russia were living in the Caucasus region. And at that time, universal conscription was introduced across Russia. This came like a bombshell to the Dukhobors, who, as you know, were pacifists and believed in not bearing arms. For the first several years of conscription, they participated, albeit highly reluctantly. But by the 1890s, they had reached a group decision to refuse to bear arms any further, to lay down their guns and their put away their military uniforms and refuse to participate. As you can imagine, this did not go over well with Tsarist authorities, and literally hundreds of young Dukhobor men, conscripts in the Russian Imperial Army, were sent to penal battalions, which were basically prisons for military offenders, where they were tortured, incarcerated, and eventually exiled to some of the furthest reaches of Siberia in the Far East. Civilian Dukhobors as well participated in an event known as the Burning of Arms, whereby hundreds, in fact, thousands of Dukhobors gathered in the various districts that they lived in, gathered up all their firearms, swords, muskets, etc., curled them onto large bonfires and doused them with kerosene, lit them on fire as a mass demonstration or protest against killing and violence. The Tsarist authorities, again, did not look lightly on this and arrested hundreds of the protesters and, in other cases, exiled whole families and villages to different areas of the empire. And by the mid to late 1890s, the situation in Russia had become intolerable. In order to live their faith and continue their way of life as they knew it, the Dukhobors would have to look elsewhere outside of Russia. And they looked, initially at places like Hawaii, the island of Cyprus in the Mediterranean, and other places, but it was ultimately Canada that they decided upon. This was in no small part because Canada at the time was opening up its Western territories and was looking for strong agrarian peasants who were close to the land and who could pioneer the land and open it up for settlement. And the Dukhobors fit this bill precisely.
Ashley, what is the significance of the name Dukhobor? This is a fascinating story.
The name Dukhobor translates in English to spirit wrestler. And it was a name that was given to the Dukhobors derisively in the 17th century, whereby an archbishop of the Orthodox Church basically said, you guys are nothing but a bunch of spirit wrestlers. And the Dukhobors adopted that name, embraced it, saying, yes, we wrestle with the Spirit of God. In other words, with the inspiration and the strength of the Spirit of God, which comes from within, that inspires from within. So that the Dukhobors have adopted that name. But technically, many of the organizations of Dukhobors have highlighted the Christian aspect of their faith. So Dukhobor is kind of like a common name, but officially Their organizations were called things like the Christian Community of Universal Brotherhood in the early 20th century, later the Union of Spiritual Communities of Christ, other kinds of references to their Christian belief. And I think it's important to highlight that Dukobors are Christians in their belief. They interpret the Trinity as being God the Father, Jesus, somebody who embodies the true teachings of God, that lives a good and exemplary life, a person that Dukobors should strive to emulate. And then they believe that the Spirit of God is inspiring the human from within. And it's that Spirit of God from within that inspires other beliefs like the belief in pacifism, as Jonathan highlighted earlier, or their belief in the importance of taking care of one another, of sharing their resources with one another, of resisting exploitation, of living modestly in a way that's consistent with what they believe that that God intends for humans to live in a good way.
They are a Christian group, and there are so many factions within just Christianity itself. And Ashley, you just mentioned that the idea that God is within all of us, that there is a divinity, can set Dukobors apart from other Christian groups. And I wonder, too, about the relationship with the Bible. Jonathan, could you illuminate some of the key differences on how someone who is practicing a Dukobor lifestyle would approach the Bible and compare that with some of the more mainstream Christianities?
So as Ashley and I had mentioned earlier, the Dukobors have this strong belief in the indwelling of God, that God dwells within the soul of every person, and that, you know, it's each of our calling to listen to that voice, whether you call it a conscience or an inner voice or your soul, and be guided by it, and it implies a very direct, a very powerful and close relationship between God and each person. So things like the Bible, the scriptures, there's I think a mistaken belief that Dukobors reject the Bible, and that's not exactly true. It's more a case of the Dukobors look to the Bible and other enlightened, you know, holy psalms and sayings and teachings for spiritual guidance, but they view the Bible as ultimately having been written by man, and therefore is a fallible, imperfect document. It's there for guidance and inspiration, but ultimately it's the voice within each of us that is the truest, most authentic voice of God.
We're visiting today with Dr. Ashley Andrasov. She is an assistant professor in the Department of History at the University of Saskatchewan. And also today we are visiting with Jonathan Kalmakov. He is a lawyer in Regina and a strong history buff. And they are both very active in tracing their Dukobor heritage. And we're visiting today because of a early July Dakota date book that was based on a flawed news article dating back to 1908. And that article refers to this group as armed fanatics and calls them the Dukobors. But in truth, the armed fanatics were the Adamites. Who are the Adamites?
Adamites were a religious sect led out of Missouri and Ohio that at face value seemed to share a number of similarities with the Dukobors, in so much as they had a anti-authority stance and were very much anti-establishment in terms of the doctrines and rituals of the established church of the time. And they had read news articles about the Dukobors in Russia and their arrival in Canada in 1899, and the leader of the Adamites, one James Sharp, I believe, in 1908, decided on gathering his followers together and essentially undertaking a trek or a pilgrimage from the Midwest of the United States through Canada to meet with these Doukhobors who he believed had so much in common. Unfortunately, one of the main distinctions between the Adamites and the Doukhobors was that, as Ashley had mentioned previously, the Doukhobors were strict pacifists, whereas the Adamites did bear arms and, in fact, crossed the border into Canada at the time in 1908, heavily armed, which became an issue when they ran into a detachment of Northwest Mounted Police in Manitoba as they made their way towards Saskatchewan to meet the Doukhobors. It resulted in an armed standoff, which fortunately nobody was harmed in. But it did set the tone for what would become their sojourn in Saskatchewan, where when they did finally meet up with the Doukhobors in the Kamsack district of Saskatchewan, it very quickly became apparent that any similarities between the two groups were superficial at best, and the Doukhobors were mortified, to say the least, that this armed band had made its way to Saskatchewan and out of a false feeling of affinity. And I'm not sure what words were exchanged, but it was made very clear from the outset by the Doukhobors that they wished to have little to do with this armed group of fanatics.
Ashley, do you see this kind of thing a lot, where the Hope Pioneer had just combined two different groups? But I'm wondering, as a historian, as you see a lot of this, what is the professional ethical approach to reframing that conversation in a more modern historical understanding?
This is such an important question. There is more than one faction of Doukhobor. There were actually, throughout the 20th century, three main groups of Doukhobors, and then a few further offshoots from there. And while all three groups identified as Doukhobor, in some respects, they had very different understandings of what that meant. And in some cases, the interpretations were so divergent that one group outright rejected the other group for their interpretation, or what was seen as a misinterpretation. In the Doukhobors' case, one of the groups became particularly newsworthy. They were engaged in activities that attracted a lot of public attention, much of which was negative. They were at best ridiculed for some of their protest activities. At worst, they were cast in a very, very negative light. And because that group got the lion's share of public attention, what ended up happening is all Doukhobors were painted in the same way. A lot of newspaper reports, instead of explaining that certain characteristics or activities pertain to that particular group, they cast all Doukhobors with the same brush. And so while the majority of Doukhobors were peacefully going about their business, primarily farming in Saskatchewan, Alberta, and British Columbia, the activities of a minority faction were creating quite a stigma for the rest of the group. And it's the long-term effects, negative effects of that stigmatization that render Doukhobors today very sensitive to the way that they're portrayed in the press, in the public light. There's a keen interest to ensure that what gets said about Doukhobors in public is correct. It reflects the reality of the Doukhobors' experiences and perspectives. And that's one reason why there was such a reaction to this recent article that we're addressing today, because there is this long-seated sensitivity about how Dukkuborgs have been represented or, in fact, misrepresented in the past.
Well, and you both have been very active, either creating websites or working with the government of Canada to get broader recognition. There's genealogy websites, there's documentaries, there are books in the works. Jonathan, how would you say the Dukkuborgs are treated in Canada now, realizing that they never faced the same discrimination in Canada that they did in Russia? But have you seen a change since the arrival in Canada? Has it been chronicled?
Definitely. I mean, if the Dukkuborgs were openly persecuted in Russia, as they were throughout much of the 18th and 19th centuries, the pressures that the Dukkuborgs faced in Canada were in some ways no less intense, but they were much more subtle. Mm. It wasn't a matter of imprisonment and exile. It was the forces of assimilation, of the pressures of speaking English and of dressing and holding land and behaving the way other Canadian settlers on the prairies in the early 1900s were. And those assimilative pressures, along with the sensationalist media reporting as a result of some factions, again, as Ashley mentioned, really did create a stigma, not only as between, you know, non-Dukkuborgs and Dukkuborgs, but you know, within the Dukkuborg community itself, where you know, many several generations of Dukkuborgs you know, no longer identified with the group, or were pressured, you know, pressured to look elsewhere for an identity. You know, that those sort of pressures, and of course you can throw in the Cold War, and where it wasn't necessarily popular to be of Russian ancestry at that time either, and it did lead to a bit of a fraying in terms of the group identity, and that was probably at its peak, at its strongest point in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Canada today is, you know, especially from the 1970s onward, has placed much more emphasis on multiculturalism, where, you know, we're not so much a melting pot as perhaps the United States is characterized, but more of a mosaic of many different cultures. And over the last generation or two, it's become quite acceptable indeed to be a hyphenated Canadian, whether that's a Jewish Canadian or an Irish Canadian, or in this case, a Dukkuborg Canadian. And that's, you know, that's the sort of environment that Ashley, myself, and other younger Dukkuborgs find ourselves in. And yet there are still vestiges of, you know, what can only be described as, you know, yellow journalism and sort of poor media reporting from decades gone by that sometimes rear their head, and many of us feel inclined to try to set straight and seek a more fair, balanced, and accurate portrayal of the Dukkuborgs as a group and their contribution to Canada.
Well, we're very glad that you did, and this has been a fascinating conversation. Ashley and Jonathan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ashley Androsov is an assistant professor in history at the University of Saskatchewan. She's currently writing a book, Spirit Wrestling, The Dukkuborg Problem in Russia and in Canada, and making a documentary about the Dukkuborgs. You can find out more at dukkuborglivingbook.ca. Dukkuborg is spelled D-O-U-K-H-O-B-O-R. Jonathan Kalmakoff is a lawyer with a keen interest in his Dukkuborg ancestry. You can visit his website at dukkuborg.org. Coming up on Main Street, Tom Eastern talks about his online Willow Creek Folk School that mixes entertainment and history. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Calling it a simple and effective step to help slow the spread of COVID-19, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz has issued an executive order to require Minnesotans to wear face masks while indoors in public places. The order takes effect Saturday morning at 12 a.m. Minnesota Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan lost a brother to COVID-19 earlier this year.
My mask protects you, your mask protects me, and when we both wear them, it keeps both of us that much safer. Today's announcement is the best thing that we can do to make public places safe all across the state. It's how we keep businesses open, it's how we socialize safety, and it's how we embrace a new normal in this moment. But above all, we do this because it will help save lives.
There are exceptions for people with certain medical conditions and for children ages 5 and under. Two more individuals have passed away with COVID-19 in North Dakota, bringing the statewide death toll to 96. The patients were a man in his 70s from Burley County and a woman in her 90s from Cass County. They both had underlying health conditions. Additionally, 160 new individuals from 26 counties have tested positive for the novel coronavirus, bringing the new statewide positive total to 5,367. Cass County had 42 new cases, Burley County had 39, Morton County had 12, Williams County had 11, and Stutsman County had 8. There were 6 new cases in Grand Forks County, 5 in both Benson and Ward counties, and 4 new cases in both Mountrail and Richland counties. There were 3 new cases in Burke County, and Bowman, McKenzie, McLean, Stark, and Walsh counties each had 2 new cases, while Barnes, Cavalier, Eddy, Emmons, Kidder, Mercer, Oliver, Ransom, Sargent, Sioux, and Wells counties each had 1 new case apiece. There are currently 52 people hospitalized, and there have been 317 total hospitalizations, 4,407 people who have recovered, leaving 864 active confirmed cases. And new research shows rural Minnesotans can often afford a similar or better quality of life than their metro area counterparts, despite having overall lower wages. Kelly Ash is a research associate with the Center for Rural Policy and Development.
The 3 main drivers of that is housing is significantly cheaper in rural Minnesota, child care is significantly lower, and taxes were also quite a bit lower. And so those were kind of like the primary drivers that made cost of living so much cheaper out here, thus making the median wages a little bit more competitive in some areas.
Ash's research found adults in the Twin Cities need to make nearly $20 an hour to meet the cost of living versus $14 an hour in rural Minnesota. Housing costs for a family of 3 is nearly $400 more expensive per month in the Twin Cities than in greater Minnesota, and taxes were about $260 lower each month in rural areas of the state. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by a very familiar voice to Main Street. That's Tom Easer, distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University and the creator and voice behind our Plainsfolk essays here on Main Street. Tom, it's always a pleasure to have you on.
And a pleasure to be with you, Doug. Thanks.
And today we're going to talk about a new enterprise you've been handling now for weeks, I guess, since late April, the Willow Creek Folk School. Tell us about it. Where did that come from?
Yeah, it seems like new, but we realize it's been going on since April. I think we're up to episode 14 now. The Willow Creek Folk School. Well, to some extent, this comes out of the situation that prevailed. You know, we realized pretty soon that we were hunkering down for a long haul with at least semi-isolation. And we pretty much gone into, you know, hermit-like isolation in our place on Willow Creek here. And we didn't want to lose touch, let the brand go away, whatever you want to put it like that. And I've also come to a stage of life where I've begun to resurrect some old interest. And one is I'm a unreconstructed folkie from the 1970s. You know, did some coffee houses, did some bar rooms. It's no way to make a living, but it does make leave a watermark on you. And that's combined, though, with a genuine interest, indeed reverence for folk tradition in this region where we live, the Great Plains of North America. And so this came out. Also, we were gearing up in our household for all manner of digital communications that we need professionally here as educators. And so it emerged. And my partner, Suzanne Kelly, she was game to essentially produce the thing out of our, well, also, you know, we at home together quite a bit, began to do scurry things like name the locations around our property. So we've got, I'm talking from the Lawtonville Library, named after our favorite historical editor in our home. And I've got the Prairie Garden out back, and we do the show in the Willow Creek Folk School from the Salon on Willow Creek. All these things, actually, you can tag in Instagram and Facebook as locations today. It's kind of hilarious.
Well, the salon view is you're sitting on a bench in front of a window that shows your yard in the background when there's enough light. On Friday, there was a storm coming, so you were using the lightning and the thunder as, I guess, sort of emphasis to help move the show along. But let's use that word, the salon. The salon was an old tradition from, the 18th century, where typically in Paris you'd have intellectuals come together and sort of share ideas?
Yeah, you know me enough that that's kind of a spoof, right? Except it is kind of true to those ideals. We've had literary readings and house concerts in that room at our place. So, you know, Dr. Kelly's salon really is that it's in line with that tradition.
Suzanne Kelly is editor-in-chief of the NDSU Press, which also published your book, which is referred to oftentimes. That's Pacing Dakota. And I mentioned the Plains Folk essays you do on our show. Pacing Dakota is kind of a blown-up version of that. And the show can be found, your Willow Creek Folk Show streams live on Facebook on the Plains Folk Facebook page.
That's right. Yeah, we set up a Mevo, you know, a recording and streaming device in the salon, you see, and it goes live every Friday night.
Well, for me, it's songs and history and literature and musings and personal messages. It's very informal, but it's got kind of a structure to it. And you sing quite a bit, just like you do on your Plains Folk essays. You often burst into song. What is the importance of these folk songs to you and your study of history?
Hey, thanks for asking that. You know, there's the personal aspect of this, and I'm resurrecting a part of my own past, but it's also something of, I think, pretty profound importance to the Great Plains as a place in America and in the world, that there is indeed a folk culture present in our past and into our present, I think is the case. And culture defines a region. And the truth is, there's more of it than we ever suspected. Here's the wonderful irony of this. I'm doing what you might think of as old-timey stuff here, but I'm doing it live through the wonders of digital communications to people literally in Kazakhstan and New Zealand. And
wow.
And the material I'm feeding in there is, a lot of it is old, brand new. That is through digital databases like the Library of Congress, Chronicling America, and newspapers.com and other things like that. Take the old folk song that we thought we knew all about, Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim, the homesteader ballad, right? I've got more than 40 variant texts of that, including one from Emmons County, North Dakota. Now, that's a whole new realm of literary study, because instead of having mere fragments, oh, it's here, and oh, there's another version there. Now I've got three of them. No, I got 43 of them. And I've only started. I bet I could come up with 100 variant texts of Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim if I really set a couple days to searching.
I was really intrigued by this one song that I think you had it on last Friday. It might have been an Irish ditty, sort of from the Midwest, I should say. But it was based on the Georgia Tech fight song.
Tech fight song is based on it. The son of a gambler, I'm a rambling rake of poverty and a son of a gambler, which becomes a rambling wreck from Georgia Tech. And many other folk songs in this part of the country, including one from Minot that I was singing last week.
So how do you structure a school session? How do you and your producer, Suzanne Kelly, work on this?
Essentially, I try to keep it around half an hour. And I figure, okay, I've got time to sing three songs and BS about them. Now, that the BS line takes two forms. One of them is actual critical commentary, you know, drawing upon. I've had some formal study in the musicology of the ballad, but also quite a bit of background in history and literature. And so I bring that stuff to it to actually talk about this. And I think there are, I'll be doing scholarly publishing out of this whole line of work. You know, several pieces I've laid out, which I'll get around to them when they move to the front burner. So pick several songs. And if I got a couple of them, well, here's the one that'll either complement or contrast with those two in a nice way. And then I'll work them up and then work up the commentary around them. And then commonly you'll find there's a little something in there. Like last week, I had a little tribute to some old friends who've been married, who are celebrating their 38th wedding anniversary. I think also a little talk about Joseph Haidt, the great German-Russian linguist and historian. So some stuff comes in there that, well, and then the personal stuff, you know. Critical commentary runs into, I'm talking about the variant texts of Home on the Range. And invariably that leads to the time when I was sitting in a crowded room singing Home on the Range and noticed Martin Murphy in the front row singing along.
Wow.
All kinds of stuff like that, because I'm so damned old, Doug. I've got a story about any song you can come up with.
Well, I was intrigued also because you're doing this, you're using this 21st century technology to do a Facebook Live performance, which incidentally is archived on that Plains Folk Facebook page.
Yeah.
So that
at facebook.com/plainsfolk, one word.
Yep. And you're also researching these folk songs using 21st century technology, these digital searches. You can actually, you know, find variations on these songs by putting the lyrics up there.
Oh, yeah. And the way some things get circular on that. So researching is a history of groves. You've heard me talk about that in Plains Folk.
Yes, I have.
These timber claims from the 1880s that became landmarks and public places, and they're a neglected part of our cultural history in this part of the country. And I went out searching for some of those and found the sites, including some 140-year-old cottonwood trees growing out there. Oh, this is great. Well, so last week singing Kein Schöner Land, the German-Russian folk song that I learned from the compilations of Dr. Haidt, then the digital search leading to driving my truck out onto a lonely section road and locating these shelter belts fed back into thinking about German Russians and their longing for the linden groves of the old country. I always say if you live long enough, everything starts to come together and unravel at the same time.
Well, I also was intrigued by this information you share with your viewers that when you make these searches, what you discover is they come back as indicating a predominantly white Anglo male kind of culture, which are typically the people who've written the history of the 19th and 20th century.
Yeah. So last week, making a conscious attempt, I did my own translation of Kein Schöner Land, which I think it's not bad for a singable English translation to sing alongside the German, original German. That's trying to bring our ethnic cultures in, but I can only handle a couple of other languages, so somebody else is going to have to do a lot of that. But in addition, what about women's singing? I'm finding most of these variant texts from newspapers, they're edited by white males, Anglo-Americans, and they're buddies with the other old guys around town who bring in their songs, or they pick them up in the pool hall or whatever it is. And it's pretty much a white male province. Ah, but there are other things. Okay. Associations, women run associations and they sing in them. So this week I'll be talking about Luna Kelly, the great songwriter for the Farmers Alliance and People's Party in the 1890s. And so I have to do a little affirmative action to get out at women's singing, because it's buried deeper historically than the male province.
Well, when you perform this way, and I suspect in your classroom as well, it helps to be creative, to make things interesting, to get people thinking deeply about stuff. And as I was listening to you talk about this, I was thinking, how do historians deal with that inevitable distortion, you know, because who writes the history sort of creates a distortion there, to uncover the more objective reality of that time?
When I teach methods of doing history at NDSU, I have the word of the week. And every semester, one week, the word is, ready for it, epistemology.
There you go.
how do we know what we know? What's been the survival rate of the evidence? And is that selective or is it representative? And then that's even before the historians get hold of it. So I'm trying to part that curtain a little bit there and get the fuller range of singing. I tell you, a great one for getting at women's singing. Ballad books, young women who wrote down songs from their mother's household and took them into their own married households. I've located several of those. And now I'm just getting on to the idea that there also is a middle-class women's province that falls in between the heyday of sheet music in late 19th century and early 20th century and the advent of radio, where songs are being proliferated by limited copies of sheet music that middle-class women buy, and then they play in their parlors and maybe teach in piano lessons to others like that. And that's not your typical folk constituency that you think of, but there it is, and it's undeniable.
Well, you look at the recipes that pervade this part of the world, for example, and their casseroles typically, or hot dishes, we would often refer to them. And there's some amalgamation of something that really came from the old country, but this is the only way you could make it here.
Yeah. You know what my theme song here is for the Willow Creek Folk School? It's Hot Dish Highway.
Well, Tom, you are a Kansas farm boy, so let's get a little history on you. How did you find your way here, and what drew you to the study, the deep study of history?
Kansas farm boy, I always say alfalfa drove me off the farm, and there's a good bit of truth to that, you know. I was the one-man haying crew on the place. Loading up those Texas semis day after day. But that was better than stacking in the loft, which is even worse.
You know, I did hay baling one day on a farm north of Moorhead 50 years ago. I still remember it. They had just gone from the small bales to the 70-pound bales, and we did 1,500 of them. And I thought, boy, this is not the life for me.
Well, see, I understand exactly what you're saying. And so I'm of the generation that I call the last picture show generation. We mostly left the farm behind. It was in the rearview mirror. But another thing I picked up from that experience was tractor radio on the fender of the open cab of a 930 case tractor and spending 12, 16 hours a day there listening to Kansas City Royals baseball and country music. And that led me to learning basics of musical technique in country music. Then I get off to college and there's this folky scene, right? And I was the guy with the wrong kind of hat there. but I kind of flowed into that. And then the more layers I added, the more that began to fuse with scholarly interests. So I was thinking, I found there's better money in talking about the stuff as a scholar than singing in coffee houses.
Well, tell us the story behind your hat, because I've seen it a few times. It's very distinctive.
Well, you know, there's four or five of them. Some of them are Stetsons and some of them are Akubras. I always say that we old McCain voters take melanoma seriously. and that's true. And that's true. You don't find me going around exposing a lot of skin out here. Even in North Dakota. And then the amount of time I spent in Australasia, people are highly conscious of that kind of exposure there, hence the popularity of the Akubra hat from Adelaide, South Australia. So there's that, but you know that a hat is always a case of symbolic interaction too.
Yeah. Well, there's another aspect of this and that intrigues me, and that is you come from a place in Kansas, and you often talk about places in North Dakota, and I'm from Minnesota, and anybody who's spent any time in a state knows that states sort of partition themselves.
Yeah.
There's a West River, East River, there's a you know, Great Lakes part, or there's a metro, but there's an identity that sort of exists there, and it came from something, and often it came from the people who settled there initially, but there's an interesting cultural fabric around the way people identify within a particular place.
Yeah, that starts with a what you might call vernacular sense. There's a folk impulse there that this is a place and we identify with it. And these songs are very much part of that. One of the great phenomena of folk song is localization. You got an old song, let's make it about our place here. And it makes the place a place. Just like we made the salon on Willow Creek a place, you know. You can tag it on Facebook now. There's that. But then there's always a feedback loop, because a Willa Cather or an Elwin Robinson, or, you know, a literary person, an artist, a historian, somebody like that picks up on that. And they try to express that popular sense of things. And then that becomes standard. There are things that are part of us that we only are because Ole Rovog or Willa Cather or Walter Webb or Elwin Robinson said that for us better than we were saying it ourselves. And then we all said, yeah, that's what I've been trying to say. That's what I've been. Okay, now you've come to another proposition with Plains Folk or the Willow Creek Folk School, or I guess my life. I try to be true to that folk sense and express it for, not that I always approve of all of it, and I might even be gently chiding about some of it, but you can't tell, you can't dismiss me as, well, you're not one of us. The hell I'm not, you know? I drive an F-150.
Well, history is intriguing in many ways, and one way I find it particularly interesting is trying to better understand the present by looking at something in the past. If you were to describe what we're living in now, what part of the past, where would you go to sort of as a reference point?
Well, it's almost like there's a matrix of them. This Friday night, I'll be singing a song called Tariff on the Brain. It's based on the Irish Highwayman ballad, Brennan on the Moor. But then the chorus comes in, a tariff on the brain, tariff on the brain. Don't trust a politician who has tariff on the brain. Now, as a farmer, I really identify with that today. But at the same time, with my method students, I had them late last term reading the scholarly literature of the pandemic of 1918-1919.
Yes.
Jesus, that's scary.
Yeah.
Talk about reliving it.
They argued about masks then. They argued about businesses being open or closed then. It is eerie almost.
Oh, it is. And, okay, I don't want to get too political here, but then, as now, there was an absence of national leadership in what do we think about this and how should we respond to it? And consequently, people were left to their own devices.
Well, how crazy things can change in just a short amount of time.
Yeah, and you're in your basement and here I am in mine, even though we call it the Lawtonville Library. The danger would be we become a bunch of hermits. We're not doing that, are we?
No, we are keeping in communication, thankfully.
Yeah.
Tom Eason, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Doug. Always a pleasure.
Tom is a distinguished professor of history at NDSU, and he and Suzanne Kelly are the creators of the Willow Creek Folk School from the Salon on Willow Creek. You can hear it Friday, see it Friday evenings at 8 Central. It's a live Facebook stream, and it's archived on the Facebook page for Plains Folk. Thanks, Tom.
Bye.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Daybook for July 22nd. Herbert Fish had an interesting job. In 1907, he was hired as the first curator for the State Historical Society of North Dakota. He had training in U.S. history and economics, had done archaeological work in Wisconsin, and also taught. His specialty was native artifacts. He spent every summer from 1907 to 1915 in the field with native people and settlers from whom he collected items and information about their history. He also became proficient in Native Sign Language and recorded stories and songs on cylinder records. Fish was busy in the summer of 1912. On this date that year, he had returned to Bismarck from the Fort Berthold Reservation. He had spent almost 2 weeks on the reservation gathering relics and data. He spent time in the area of Armstrong, a community later known as Nishu, which is now under Lake Sakakawea. Fish reported 400 Sioux and Arikara people camped near Armstrong in McLean County for a religious convocation. Several Christian ministers gave addresses. A bishop confirmed a class of Sioux children. Fish gave two speeches about a respect for the past and advancement for the future. Those in attendance also sang hymns in English, Sioux, and Arikara. Fish also was the best man for a wedding. His return to Bismarck was short-lived. Days later, he left for a 2-day trip to Cannonball to see native rock art depicting birds and bison. A few days later, he addressed a development meeting in Energy, an old McLean County town near present-day Riverdale. His speech was about the conservation of historical spots. And later in August, he went to Elbow Woods on the Fort Berthold Reservation to assist a colleague in gathering information from residents. In 1915, Fish left the State Historical Society to take a position in the Department of History at Minot Normal College. He would later move on to the State Normal School in Ellensburg, Washington. And it was in Washington in 1934 that he passed away at age 59. Today's Dakota Datebook written by Jack Dura. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, protecting families from fraud and scams, and helping more than 62,000 family caregivers who help make it possible for their loved ones to live at home. Creating real possibilities in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream live at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, News Director Dave Thompson usually joins us on Fridays to talk about the week's big stories, but he'll be with us tomorrow to analyze the news behind the headlines. And Sue Balcom will drop by for another Main Street Eats. Her topic is a summer favorite, it's homegrown tomatoes. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.